The third case for oral argument this morning is Lucille Schoen versus Thomas Luby. For the appellant is Mr. John Hughes, an attorney from Sioux Falls. For the appellees, Mr. Edwin Evans, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Hughes, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justices of the South Dakota Supreme Court, members of the faculty and students of the University of South Dakota School of Law, and members of the public. My name is John Hughes, and I represent the plaintiffs and appellants, Lucille and John Schoen, in this case. This appeal is about maintaining the well-established and long-reaffirmed principles and proper boundaries of closing argument in civil cases. This case is about closing argument misconduct and about whether argument by invective against the parties and their counsel has a place in the courtrooms of South Dakota.
Was the jury instructed that oral argument is not evidence?
Your Honor, the jury was instructed in instruction number 4 that the final argument is intended to help the jury in understanding the evidence and applying the law. And it does state that their remarks are not evidence. They were instructed. Instruction number 4, Your Honor.
Okay.
This court has the opportunity to enunciate clearly to all the lawyers and judges in South Dakota that insults and abusive and untruthful remarks have no place in closing arguments, and that where the proper boundaries of closing argument are exceeded, the remedy is to grant a new trial. This appeal follows a defense jury verdict in which Lucille Schoen brought an action for medical negligence and intentional infliction of emotional distress against Sioux Falls gynecologist Thomas L. Luby and Sioux Valley Clinic, his employer. Lucille Schoen's husband, John, brought a separate cause of action for loss of spousal consortium. Dr. Luby was Mrs. Schoen's treating physician for vaginal prolapse, a condition in which the muscles of the female pelvic floor have been weakened, generally through a combination of childbirth and age. Dr. Luby treated Mrs. Schoen for this condition from January through September 1996 and performed 2 surgeries that were at issue at trial. During this time, Lucille was undergoing follow-up treatment for breast cancer. Mrs. Schoen was treated by Dr. Luby and her oncologist for chronic anxiety and high blood pressure during this time. The first procedure performed by Dr. Luby on January 24 of 1996 was a procedure called a vaginal sacral Gore-Tex suspension. Mrs. Schoen's medical expert testified at trial that this procedure, even if it had been successful, would have corrected only a portion of her condition. Mrs. Schoen also claimed that Dr. Luby did not obtain her informed consent. Mrs. Schoen also claimed that Dr. Luby inadequately documented her medical treatment and care in the medical records. And she also claimed that Dr. Luby was negligent in managing her post-operative care. The second procedure performed by Dr. Luby on September 3 of 1996 was to remove the Gore-Tex graft material that had eroded into Lucille's vaginal wall and caused a vaginal ulcer. Lucille alleged that Dr. Luby recklessly or intentionally inflicted emotional distress upon her by comments he made to her during post-operative pelvic examinations in September of 1996 and by his conduct following the September 3rd, 1996 procedure. After her last appointment with Dr. Luby in September of 1996, Lucille referred herself to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and she underwent a third, and this time successful, surgery to correct her vaginal prolapse. Immediately prior to closing arguments, the defense made a renewed separate motion for a directed verdict on the medical negligence and emotional distress claims, and also made a separate motion to strike the Schoen's claim for punitive damages. These motions were all denied by the trial court, and notably, the defendants and appellees did not file a notice of review on any issue in this appeal. During his portion of the closing argument, defense counsel argued.
Do you see any significance in the fact these motions are denied?
I think they were properly denied, Your Honor, because there was more than sufficient evidence to overcome those motions. The significance, I think, that denial has for purposes of this appeal is the closing argument portion where defense counsel argued that intentional misconduct was needed to support an award of punitive damages, which is not the law in South Dakota. There are much lesser standards than specific intent that support the grant of punitive damages in a tort case. And so it's disingenuous for the defense to argue that, well, my argument to the jury that intentional misconduct was required was woven into the closing argument by defense counsel in order to impugn the Schoen's ability to collect punitive damages, because there was no specific intent to cause harm under South Dakota law that's required in order to support punitive damages. Nor is there a specific intent requirement to support a jury finding of intentional or reckless infliction of emotional distress, which is what the law actually states. But here is the closing argument. Defense counsel argued, my partner is going to talk to you about informed consent, that issue. I'm going to touch on intentional infliction of emotional distress for a moment. So these comments are all made within the context of intentional infliction of emotional distress for the moment. This claim troubles me, he said, not because it has any merit, but I don't know Dr. Luby personally. I know him professionally from having associated with him through this trial. I don't even think he knows this, but he delivered my second child. I'm sure he doesn't remember it, but he is a quiet, professional person, and to have these accusations made against him troubles me. Why is this claim being made? You know what this type of claim is usually reserved for, this intentional infliction. If I have just so much hate for another person that I call them and tell them that their child just got killed in a motor vehicle accident. Your Honor, I'm going to object. It's highly improper. Counsel is testifying about the basis for a cause of action, his personal opinion, improper personalization of the evidence. It's just designed to inflame the jury and has nothing to do with the facts or the evidence in this case. The court, well, overruled. I'll allow it.
Mr. Hughes,
yes.
I haven't counted them up, but it looks like the word I, counsel was talking about himself, was used probably close to 10 times before you objected.
Yes, Your Honor, but all the comments were made in the context of the counsel's statements about intentional infliction of emotional distress. Now, I will concede readily to the court, as former Justice Amundson said back in 1999 in Citibank, South Dakota against State, in many cases an attorney will be faced with strategic choices, any one of which may lead to a favorable result. An attorney must make an educated guess as to which course of action is most likely to succeed. I made an educated guess. It got to the point where this was not tolerable. I am aware of the principle that trial courts are allowed wide latitude in ruling on whether remarks during closing argument are proper or improper. But clearly at this point, this had completely crossed the line, because counsel is now completely misstating the law of intentional infliction of emotional distress. And I attempted, Your Honor, to make all the bases for my objections very clear in my objection.
Had you made any determination or required them to produce any evidence as to whether Dr. Luby had been, as to whether lawsuits had been brought against Dr. Luby in the past?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a very astute point, because the court, upon motion of the defendants, prohibited the plaintiffs and their counsel and all witnesses from discussing, implying, testifying, or mentioning the presence or absence of any other claims or litigation involving Dr. Luby. And so, other than objecting, Your Honor, and after the judge overruled this, I had a situation where it looked to me like the trial court was going to let just about anything in. And I think personally this was kind of an invited response, where counsel was trying to create a situation where I would return the same tactic, respond in the same way, and create a grounds where we're here for a different reason today. I chose to live within the terms and the parameters of the motion in limine, even though I knew, the defense counsel knew at that time, that his firm had represented an entity owned by Dr. Luby in a case that was heard by this court in 1997, Kaiser against Southeast Properties. And I also knew that in October of 2000, defense counsel had represented Dr. Luby in a medical malpractice trial for 4 or 5 days that was tried in Second Circuit Court in Sioux Falls with Judge Sertzka presiding.
Was your objections stated in before the court at the bench, or were they stated in open in front of the jury, or were they stated in chambers?
In the presence and hearing of the jury, Your Honor.
So the ruling by the trial court judge also came in the presence of the jury?
It did, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that point is even clearer, where the court is reinforcing really the implication that this comment is fair, where counsel went on to say, so what is intentional infliction doing in this lawsuit? Well, let's try to get some punitive damages. I mean, if this is the lotto or Powerball or whatever they call it, let's really roll the dice big. And how do we do that? We can't do that with a negligence lawsuit. We have to say Dr. Luby intentionally did something. So let's see how we can weave this into intentional misconduct. Then we can put in his wage reports. And not only that, Sioux Valley, a nonprofit corporation that's owned by all of us, let's show their balance sheet. And I object to that, Your Honor. Sioux Valley Hospital is not a publicly owned corporation. That is inappropriate, inaccurate, and it's an outrageous statement. It's a private corporation. And then Justice Sabers, the court. Well, it's argument. I'll allow Mr. Evans to make his argument. At that point, the imprimatur of the trial court is squarely behind all of these clearly objectionable comments and themes. Really, the theme, and perhaps this answers the question, the themes that I was objecting to were this: that the Schoens have manufactured a case, that they went to their lawyer to do so in order to reap a windfall that we're all going to pay for. Those are the unmistakable themes of the defense closing argument.
Is that the equivalent of a plaintiff or a claimant injecting insurance into a lawsuit, which almost always results in a mistrial?
I would totally agree with that, Your Honor. I think it was improper. Now, I could have made a motion for a mistrial. I could have, I suppose. The cost, quite frankly, the cost to my clients of bringing this case to trial is significant. It always is. Largely the price of medical expert testimony, to have physicians that are clinical practitioners and board certified that are willing to and competent to do this sort of thing is expensive.
How many day trial was it?
It was a 5-day trial, Your Honor, spread over 2 weeks. We had Martin Luther King Jr. holiday on a Monday, and we concluded on a Tuesday.
Mr. Hughes, I think it's always difficult for the court to read the record and then to determine whether or not it actually influenced the jury or it prejudices the plaintiff in this case. How do we determine that?
I think, you know, quite frankly, Your Honor, I can tell you that my office interviewed the jurors afterwards.
We can't look at that.
We can't. I mean, I can, and I want to be very careful about that. I don't want to engage in the same tactics. I know what the jurors had to say about the arguments, but of course we cannot invade the province of the jury room, and it would be inappropriate for me to represent what those statements are to the court, I think. I'm certainly not planning on doing that.
Well, Mr. Hughes, don't we, or should we, look at the cause of actions here? This was not a contract action or a dispute over an insurance clause. You're first accusing the defendant of intentional infliction of emotional distress, which is a pretty strong accusation. And then on top of that, you're asking for punitive damages to punish him. Doesn't that invite a strong response?
Well, but the response that was made was to impugn my client's motives in bringing the suit, which were nowhere at issue in the case, suggesting my clients are playing lotto with the civil justice system is an outrageous statement. I said it at the trial in front of the judge. I reaffirm that today. If our civil justice system has gotten to the point where jurors can actually be told by lawyers in the courtroom that the civil justice system is about lotteries and Powerball and winning big money that we all pay for, I think we're way down the slippery slope. And that's why, you know, during my rebuttal of, in the closing argument, rather than resort to the same tactics and argue that I know that defense counsel's lying and Dr. Luby's been sued before and he's had a trial before and Mr. Evans represented him before and Dr. Luby has been in a case where he sought punitive damages from the plaintiff on a counterclaim, Kaiser against Southeast Properties. It's not as if, by the same token, I knew at that time that defense counsel knew that this was Lucille and John Schoen's first experience with the civil justice system. They had never, have never been involved in a lawsuit before. Now, unless this is gonna all boil down to a street fight, what is plaintiff's counsel supposed to do other than exercise best efforts to give the trial court a heads up, to state the bases for the various objections in a thematic way, and then after being overruled twice, what do you do? The jury has already, that jury retired to its deliberations, all 12 of them, assuming that it was okay to appeal to their self-interest as the owners of a private nonprofit corporation, which is nowhere relevant to any issue in the case. It has nothing to do with the case. Even if that is a correct statement of the law, which I dispute, and I note the Banner Health System case is taking a related type concept up, but Judge Schreier certified that issue to this court to see if there's some type of charitable trust purpose that attaches to the assets of a nonprofit corporation. So we are way off the edge, in my opinion, during this closing argument. And
did you make a motion to the trial court that once Mr. Evans had said that about his relationship with Dr. Luby, that should have opened up the issue of how many lawsuits that had been brought against him in the past and so forth?
You know, I've replayed that scenario in my mind about 100 times. That's probably an understatement. I thought it's in the record. I can't cite you the pages, and these were bench trial discussions, but I can tell you that Mr. Evans made numerous statements to the effect that he would make a motion for a mistrial at various points during the proceedings. I did not want a mistrial. I will just frankly state that. Number one, I thought the judge was going to deny it, and it would just further reinforce in the jury's mind that all of this is proper argument. I mean, I can second guess myself, but I know that if I had to do it over again, I'd do it the same way for those same reasons.
I'm not going so much to the mistrial motion, but I'm going to, while you still had an opportunity to argue as the plaintiff in the case, did you make a motion to the court that Mr. Evans had opened up the question of how many lawsuits Dr. Luby had been involved in, and now that should be, you should be able to argue that in your closing or your rebuttal?
I did not, Your Honor. Both sides had rested, obviously. It was late in the day. The judge is leaving on a vacation. I mean, but no, the answer is no. I mean, candidly, no, I did not.
As far as the misstatement on the law, in your rebuttal, did you point out what the law was that the judge had instructed them on, or did you make any comment after that?
I referred the jury to what the jury instructions said. I told the jury to read the jury instructions, and that was what was at issue in this case, not the statements of counsel. I also attempted to appeal to the jurors' sense of civil duty, of the high calling to which they were sworn as jurors in a system where we bring our cases to courts. You know, for example, defense counsel concludes his argument, now emboldened after two objections are overruled. She had a surgery in 1996 that didn't work. She went to a lawyer and we're off to the races. That's what this lawsuit is about. Your Honors, that is not true. Defense counsel knew that John and Lucille Schoen, when he made those comments, testified in their depositions that Lucille Schoen's oncologist, Dr. David Elson, when she heard from Lucille what was going on with Dr. Luby, he told Lucille, Dr. Elson did, to go see Dr. William Watson, who was then chief of staff at Sioux Valley Hospital. Dr. William Watson referred the Schoens to Jeannie Schwarting, the risk administrator for Sioux Valley Hospital. Dr. Watson wrote to the Schoens and said, "You and your husband may find it useful to visit with Jeannie Schwarting." During the deposition testimony of John and Lucille Schoen, they both testified, and defense counsel knew this, that Jeannie Schwarting told them to seek legal advice. You see, it wasn't off to the races. She went to a lawyer. They cooked up this case to profit by a game of chance. It's false. All those character assassinations are false. Not only are they outside of the record and irrelevant to the issues in the law in the case, they were false.
What's your best argument that it prejudiced your clients?
Well, I think one of the issues is the jury was out an hour. That's it.
What does that prove?
I think it proves that they didn't deliberate, Your Honor. I think it proves that they didn't look through the exhibits. They didn't consider the testimony. They accepted Mr. Evans' arguments that this was all about greed and profit and lawyers running off to the races with their clients and attacking a physician. That's what this was all about. And there's no basis in the record for that. My client's motives in bringing this suit were never at issue in this case until closing argument.
Your time has expired. In fact, you've got an extra minute. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Evans, you have 20 minutes.
Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the court. I'm going to address each of the comments in a moment, but before we do so, I want to start with four what I think are important points to make kind of from a broad perspective regarding the case. First of all, the trial did last over a week and constitute over 1,000 pages of transcript testimony. Number two, I think the context of the remarks is important. My statements were all made in relation to the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim and the claim for punitive damages based on that claim. It consisted of four pages, parts of four pages regarding my final argument on that issue out of the 1,000 pages of transcript. Third, the standard of review has been, as has been noted by Justice Savers and Justice Meyer-Henry, is an abuse of discretion, and the trial court has wide latitude on ruling on objections. And last, as noted by Judge Meyer-Henry, it must be shown that the remarks caused the jury to reach, in all probability, a different result. And in this case, it must show that the defense verdict in all probability was erroneous, the jury ignored the court's instructions and the law, and the court's instructions that final argument wasn't the law and all of the law on intentional infliction of emotional distress. Going to the comments, my first comment that is at issue, and I just kind of take these chronologically as they were presented. This is the one that I said I didn't know Dr. Luby personally. I know him professionally from having associated him through the trial. I don't even think he knows it. He delivered my second child. I'm sure he doesn't remember it. He's a quiet, professional person. First, no objection made. Counsel just indicated it was trial strategy not to object. Didn't want to, waited and objected later. So that in and of itself should take care of that comment.
Unless, second, of course, we determine it's plain error.
That's true. And this court's never recognized plain error in a civil case. And I would think that that would be a dangerous precedent to set.
Well, it kind of did in the Wiest.
I thought the Wiest case holding discussed plain error. It was urged in the Wiest case, but specifically the holding of this court was that you didn't need to address it because you didn't find prejudicial error, so you left it for another day. Maybe today's the day, but I would think that I don't think it's too much to request counsel to make a record and object to errors occurring at the trial court level. I don't think, it's just like in the criminal cases, a defendant is not entitled to a perfect trial. Civil litigants aren't entitled to perfect trials either. And I think that to approach plain error would have to be significantly egregious and go beyond all bounds of anything within reason in order to adopt a plain error rule in a civil case. Otherwise, I think you should rely on the system and rely upon counsel to make his objections and protect his clients, as we do in all other situations.
What bothers me in that respect about your comments there is that you have an order from the trial court to keep out prior lawsuits against Dr. Luby, and, you know, and that's supposed to be a shield for your client. It's not supposed to be a sword. But you're taking it and using it as a sword to try and make him look like he's crystal clean, never been in a lawsuit before, that type of thing. That borders on the improper to me.
And I appreciate if that was my motive, but it wasn't a situation where it was trying to be inferred or implied or suggested that Dr. Luby had never been in a courtroom before, that he'd never testified before.
Well, you're saying that he's, you know, he's a quiet, private office practitioner. You're kind of implying that he only practices in the clouds and he's never, ever in trouble before. I mean, you know, we don't judge it based on motivation either. We judge it based on what we have perceived to be the effect.
I said he was a quiet, professional person, and the jury saw that. I mean, to me, the comments certainly aren't prejudicial or harmless. Mr. Hughes spends four pages of interpreting of what I was trying to say, that I was trying to vouch for his credibility and say he was saying that he was telling the truth and that he was honest, because I said he was a quiet, professional person. The jury was there for 5 days. The jury is instructed when he testified to watch and observe his demeanor to judge his credibility. They saw him on the witness stand for half a day. They observed he was a quiet, professional person. All I'm stating is what they saw. That's what they saw of him.
You didn't start it out with the evidence shows or anything like this. It comes a little bit closer to your vouching for his professional reputation and his office practice.
See, I don't get it. If I wanted to vouch for his credibility as a witness on his behalf, would I say that I just knew him professionally? Wouldn't I say that I've known Dr. Luby since he delivered my first child? I know him to be a credible, honest person.
No, because you know that'd be clearly reversed. you're way too good of a lawyer for that.
All I was trying to say was to summarize what the jury themselves had saw, and that it would be inconsistent with a person of his demeanor that they saw on the witness stand to make intentionally emotional distress type arguments and claims that they were making. That it would be inconsistent with what they saw of this person to make the kind of comments he said.
But
for intentional infliction of emotional distress.
But instead, going to the next step, you're asking the jury not to decide against themselves because Sioux Valley Hospital is owned by all of us.
Well, and I'll get into that in a moment, but I'll cover it right now. Sioux Valley Hospital is a nonprofit corporation. That came into evidence. It was in the evidence that they were a nonprofit corporation. Quite frankly, I thought common sense told me that nonprofits, nobody takes home a profit from the corporation, and that it does belong to the public. If they're ever dissolved in any way.
You should have been here then yesterday and listened to the argument.
Well, I appreciate that, but I know that you have, but I mean, if a nonprofit is dissolved, I mean, if they're sold, the sale proceeds go someplace or whatever, but if they're dissolved, I mean, they do. And to say that one comment, one sentence, there was an objection, the court reminded the jury, they said this is argument. This is argument. The court reminded it.
It's argument, so it's okay.
No, because the judge had already said that argument is not evidence. The judge had previously said the argument is not evidence, and then when the objection was made, it's argument. And then I left it alone, and I never touched it again. One sentence in over 1,000 pages of transcript.
My spin is a touch different. The judge said, overruled, it's argument. So it's okay. In other words, it's satisfactory.
Mine is different.
And you can have it. You betcha.
Right.
And so can I.
Doesn't that suggest to the jury that their verdict is going to cost them personally?
I don't think so. You must remember that what happened in this case is that plaintiff's counsel forgot to put in evidence on financial worth, and then in rebuttal moved to reopen and was allowed to. And the very last thing that this jury heard before it got the instructions and argument, the very last thing it heard is that Dr. Luby was recalled to the witness stand during rebuttal, put in that he has a financial net worth of $5.9 million, he and his wife, jointly. The next thing they heard is a Sioux Valley Clinic financial officer being called that said Sioux Valley Clinic has a $37 million net worth. And after that, he, in his opening part of his closing argument said that his constitutional law professor taught him that the way that you punish someone is that if you have a small child and they have $50 in a piggy bank, if you only take $1 away when they misbehave, they're still going to misbehave because it isn't going to teach them anything. So you want to take $5 out of their piggy bank, 10%. So in essence, he had just asked the jury and told them in his closing argument that he wanted $4.3 million. And my response, I think in a punitive damage case, all of my comments related to punitive damages. This lotto ball deal didn't have anything to do with using the system or manufacturing a case. If the plaintiff can say, you need to ring a bell, you need to hurt somebody, you need to punish them, you need to take 10% of their net worth, a defendant has to have some latitude to get up and say, you know, under the court's instructions, you're supposed to reach a fair and reasonable sum. This isn't lottery. This isn't trying to make you a millionaire. It has to be fair and reasonable. And I think that defense counsel in punitive damages case, you should never be able to say that, that medical malpractice cases or civil cases are a lottery in a get-rich scheme. I don't believe that. That's totally improper. But my comments, when limited to the punitive damage aspect, and he is allowed to say we must punish, my constitutional law professor says this is what you should do, I should be able to get up and say, remember that this isn't a lottery. And so that was the context of the remarks, and that was the context of Sioux Valley Hospital, a nonprofit. And certainly we all weren't going to pay it. They knew that Sioux Valley Hospital had a $3.7 million or $37 million net worth. There's no way that they had to worry about it was going to come out of their pockets. It was going to come out of Sioux Valley's because of their net worth. So I don't think the fact that that the jury would somehow think they were going to pay for it was, I mean, and certainly there was no implication by that by me. I just noticed that they were a nonprofit corporation. Again, if a plaintiff can say this is General Motors, why can't I bring out that, that the defendant in this case is a nonprofit corporation, a nonprofit corporation that is local and provides care to local people and that the assets belong to the community if they're ever dissolved or something happens to it.
Mr. Evans, I don't want you to refrain from responding to the other arguments you made, but I want to just shift gears and then hope that you'll come back to your other arguments.
Okay.
I just want to know about the experts and the battle of the experts and what was the relative strength of the case here?
It was a typical from that standpoint. They had an expert from Milwaukee that came in and said that we had done a lot of things wrong. Didn't do the procedure wrong, but our selection of the type of the procedure was wrong. Our note keeping wasn't as good as it could have been. We didn't get informed consent because we didn't advise of the possibility that the surgery might fail, and that we didn't follow post-operatively close enough and allowed an infection. And we had Dr. Dmitrovich from the University of South Dakota School of Law that was on the witness stand. And Judge
School of Law,
School of School of Medicine. I'm sorry. And the trial judge, Judge Caldwell, said in denying the motion for a new trial, she kind of covered that and said, you know, that this was a case that the jury, Dr. Dmitrovich was on the stand for a day and a half, underwent a full day of cross examination by Mr. Hughes, and she said the jury was well aware of the issues, the medical issues, well educated on it. And she felt that the case had been fairly tried from that standpoint. And in addition, the other experts was a Dr. Stanhope from the Mayo Clinic that did the subsequent surgery after Dr. Luby's failed. And he said that Dr. Luby didn't do anything wrong. So we had Dr. Dmitrovich, our retained expert. We had the subsequent treating surgeon, Dr. Stanhope from the Mayo Clinic, that said we didn't do anything wrong. And we had a substantial volume of medical literature that we used as learned treatise in the trial court that also said we didn't do anything wrong. So I think that, that I mean, if you want to know why the jury was only out an hour, in my opinion, it was based upon the fact that they failed miserably on their burden of proof. When we had the subsequent treating physician that said we didn't do anything wrong, we had Dr. Luby that made a nice appearance, we had Dr. Dmitrovich, and we had the literature all on our side. So it was basically four against one.
Was the verdict unanimous?
Yes. They weren't polled, as I recall. I don't believe they were polled, but the judge, the way she takes the verdict, is this the verdict of at least 10 of you, and they all raised their hand.
Mr. Evans, if this court were to determine that at least the objection, or the statements that you made that were objected to, and possibly in conjunction with the other statements that are at issue here, is there anything, if we were to find that those are inappropriate, is there anything short of a reversal at this point?
Not that I know of, no. I mean, you could admonish me, obviously,
and that's happened in other cases, and that only, I guess the concern is if we find that there are statements and lawyers go too far and it starts to undermine the system itself and the jury system and so forth, how do we as a court or as a system make sure that this does stop at some point and that it doesn't go, I mean, where does it stop? How far does it have to go in order for it to get the attention?
You know, I don't know that it's a crisis situation I mean, you came from the trial bench and probably have a better perspective on that than I do, given your familiarity with you know, counsel and arguments and trials that you've seen.
But now what if we were to say, all right, Judge Caldwell should have stopped and admonished you and not let you go any further? That didn't happen.
Yes. And that's step one. Then obviously step two is, can you say in all probability that this jury would have reached a different result? And in my opinion, you know, that's a significant leap, given the overwhelming evidence there was in favor of the defendant in this case. One other quick thing, and then I'll can sum up, but my comparing the law on emotional infliction or intentional infliction of emotional distress, he says I mischaracterized it. I kept referring to the word intentional. I mean, that's what it's called, intentional infliction. But my analogy of calling someone and saying your child has just been killed and that's an example, I think that's a totally appropriate argument. It's an analogy. I mean, if I've heard it once, I've heard 100 times of people say that, how do they demonstrate negligence? They say it by analogy. Somebody runs a stop sign. I've heard them say that, you know, the physician ran the stop sign, or the hospital ran the stop sign. That's an analogy. And I think my analogy was appropriate and proper. It comes very close to the restatement of torts, and he used an analogy. What was his analogy in his opening argument? You have to put this in context. What was his analogy? He said, first of all, he talked about William the Conqueror and 1066 and vengeance and Roman law and blood feuds and bloodletting, and then he said, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and I quote, is like a teacher scolding you for something that you know you did was wrong in school. That was his example of intentional infliction. What's the appropriate lawyering thing to do there? I responded. I talked about the essential elements, and as a part of talking about essential elements, I said it takes some intentional conduct. And if he disagreed with that, number one, the court's already been told the jury the law, and presumably they're going to follow the law on the essential elements. And if he thinks that I'm quoting it wrong, he can get up in his rebuttal and say that what Mr. Evans said is wrong. It doesn't require you calling someone and telling them their child's been intentionally injured. But, you know, that comes right out of the restatement, or pretty close to it. Mine is certainly closer than his. I'll conclude, because I think that you have a flavor from the briefs as far as what was said. Whether a new trial should be granted is obviously left to the sound discretion of the trial court. This court has said it would overrule the discretion only for a clear abuse of discretion. You know, when we see those words all the time, we start out with standard of review in all of your opinions. And we get to the point where we don't even read them. We just skip ahead because we've read them so often. And they become just kind of words of formality, when really, that they're very substantive words. They are very substantive words, the standard of review. And this court has said that abuse of discretion only occurs if no judicial mind in view of the law and the circumstances of the particular case have reached the conclusion that the trial judge reached. no judicial mind, in view of the circumstances, and again, I think the context of my remarks relating to punitive damages and that aspect of the case, I think that's important to take them in that context. And could no judicial mind find that it was not, or that could no judicial mind find it was an abuse of discretion? And at least Judge Caldwell found that it wasn't. And I just want to conclude by saying what she said. When you look at the trial as a whole, and you give the jurors the benefit of getting to know both parties, they got to know the Shones, they got to know Dr. Luby, and they also got to know the attorneys, and they heard the instructions of the court. They understood what was going on. I think the experts were good. Dr. Dmitrovich spent almost a day and a half on the witness stand explaining everything that was going on. And I just really feel that after this solid week of trial, that two or three statements made by Mr. Evans did not change the course of that trial. I really firmly believe that. And I don't believe that if Mr. Evans hadn't said exactly what he said, that the jurors would have come up with a different result. I really firmly believe that. They paid attention to this case, they took notes, they made their decision. I think that says it better than I could. The trial judge that was there and oversaw the week of trial, 1,000 pages of transcript for some fairly complex, difficult issues, and to suggest and take two or three comments of mine and then try to infer that I was suggesting something different than what I was saying. I just don't believe the jury violated their oath in this matter to follow the law and reach their verdict based on the evidence and the court's instructions. And I think that based upon Wiest versus McKinnon, I would urge the court to find that they can't say in all probability the jury would have reached a different result.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hughes, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Your Honor, there's a number of things. I don't honestly recall that example. I do recall during jury selection emphasizing on the jury the importance of reading the jury instructions and listening to the issues in the case. As far as trying to initiate a payback or something, I find a couple of comments remarkable. Nobody ever asked the jury for millions of dollars. In fact, I never asked the jury for a specific dollar amount. I told them that they had about $12,000 in medical bills that were at issue in the case, that Dr. Vitovas, our expert, had testified had no therapeutic or beneficial value to Mrs. Shone, and in fact injured her. I do recall that. I told the jury to fill in the blanks. That's what I asked them to do. So I think it's inaccurate to suggest that I was asking the jury for multiple millions of dollars. I was not. I wanted them to decide. I chose not to give them a number. I also want to address another comment. You know, the ethical rules that are in play in this case, Rule 3.4, which is cited in the brief, specifically says that a lawyer shall not, doesn't say can, it says shall not in trial allude to any matter that the lawyer does not reasonably believe is relevant or that will not be supported by admissible evidence. Strike one. Assert personal knowledge of facts and issue except when testifying as a witness. Strike three. Or state a personal opinion as to the justness of a cause, the credibility of a witness. I'm sorry, the defendants are out, Your Honor. There's three strikes here. All of those ethical principles that have been reaffirmed by this court in an opinion written by Chief Justice Miller, in which now Chief Justice Gilbertson joined a couple of years ago, are at stake in this case. I mean, I don't know what shall not requires other than shall not, Your Honors. And an admonition to Mr. Evans isn't going to help my clients, who are the litigants in this case. This court is final, is the final word on this issue. There is no appeal beyond this court. And my clients were denied a fair trial. I also want to urge on the court that the standards are not, you know, that the that my clients have to prove something in terms of prejudice. SDCL 15661 talks about trial court actions that are inconsistent with substantial justice. The court at every stage of the proceeding must disregard any error or defect in the proceeding which does not affect the substantial rights of the parties. Is having their case heard on the facts and the issues and the law and the evidence of the case not part of their substantial rights? I submit to the court that it is, and that there is no remedy for this other than to reverse and remand for a new trial. I'd also like to state that, you know, other than Will Rogers, Mark Twain is probably has a way of relating to us all. You know, the jurors are obviously are all lay people. I know that professionals and lawyers now can serve, but typically that's not the case. And in this case, it certainly was not. To paraphrase Mark Twain, words in the mind of the listener can have the impact of a lightning strike or a lightning bug, depending on the words chosen by the speaker. In other words, lightning bugs illuminate, lightning strikes blind. Closing arguments in civil cases should illuminate the facts and evidence for the jury based upon the issues in the case and not blind them to the truth. And nothing that defense counsel has said overcomes the fact that these numerous vouching credibility, personal statements, personalization are false. They're untruthful. They were used as a sword. They were intended to be used as a shield. Your Honors, please do not punish the Shones by choosing to affirm the trial court's decision in this case. I made the strategic choice not to respond in kind. And I also want to clarify one comment made by defense counsel. During closing argument, in case the court thinks, during closing argument, no evidence was reopened. The case was closed. And to the extent a statement was made to the contrary, that is not the case. The price of argument misconduct in a civil case must be a new trial. Justice and fairness to Lucille and John Schoen and the integrity of the civil justice system in South Dakota require that this court reverse the trial court's judgment based upon the jury verdict, reverse the trial court's denial of the Schoen's motion for a new trial, and remand this case for a new trial.
Mr. Hughes, would you respond to Mr. Evans' view of the strength of the expert witnesses?
Yes, Your Honor, and I have detailed that evidence succinctly, I hope, in our reply brief. I'll tell you, in the Appley's brief, numerous statements were made that medical issues were uncontradicted, and that's not true.
Well, but I want to know about that. It sounds to me like they had a substantial case of no negligence here.
Dr. Stanhope did not testify that Dr. Luby did nothing wrong, Your Honor. Dr. Stanhope acknowledged that he wasn't there when Dr. Luby did the procedure and that he knew nothing that suggested that it was inappropriately done. Now, that's a far cry from what you just heard counsel say. Dr. Stanhope from Mayo Clinic never testified that he knew from having treated Mrs. Schoen that nothing that Dr. Luby did on September 3 of 1996 or on January 24 of 1996 was wrong. That wasn't his testimony. I will say that. And I will also say that Dr. Vitimvas, who's from Milwaukee, who was our board certified OBGYN clinical practitioner, testified that Dr. Luby's choice of surgical procedure was below the standard of care. And that there was a clear plaintiff's and defendant's side to the medical testimony.
So the jury really did have to make its decision based on which experts it believed.
Again, we're supposing, Your Honor, but engaging in that speculation, I would say that the based on the amount of time that they spent on the case, Your Honor, I don't see how after, as has been said, 5 days of trial and 1,000 pages of trial testimony and all the exhibits and the medical records and the surgical procedures and the operative reports, I don't see, and not to mention the curriculum vitas of the medical experts, I don't see how the jury deliberated about much of anything, Your Honor, quite frankly. I don't think they did. That's my own personal view. I think that they accepted Mr. Evans' characterizations that my clients were possessing ulterior motivations that were improper, and that if money was awarded, that we're all going to pay for it. And I think they were out of there in an hour, Your Honor. That's my own personal opinion.
Couldn't it be portrayed as they either accept one side's version or the other?
It could, Your Honor. But, you know, who should bear the burden in a case like this, where demonstrably improper and unethical, quite frankly, statements were made by counsel at trial? Who should bear the burden of that? I know one way that we'll find out, Your Honor, with a retrial. I do know that. If this case is retried, and this court seizes the opportunity it has. There has been so much talk in the last years about where's the civility? Where's the civility in civil justice cases? Where's the civility in the courtroom? Isn't this a case of professional civility and of treating opposing parties and their counsel with respect? It doesn't mean we have to agree or disagree, but we do not need to engage in personal attacks. We do not need to impugn people's motivations that have nothing to do with the evidence or the facts of the case. We do not need to suggest to jurors that if they award money as compensation, all that our system allows for damages, that there's something shameful or wrong with that in having a jury decide the case. The business about William the Conqueror, I mean, read Oliver Wendell Holmes in the Common Law. He does a beautiful job of explaining how our tort system evolved and how blood feuds and fights and taking things to the streets is all wrong in our society. We are a government of rules, of laws, not of warlords and dictators and other methods that we're at war in this country right now to prevent. And how do we deny that heritage? Isn't that what is most important in the jury system, is for the jurors? What is this jury going to think? We have 12 jurors who deliberated in this case, who heard objections overruled that impugned my clients and me, suggested we manufactured a case for profit. Those 12 jurors are now out in their communities, into their churches, into their service clubs, into their labor unions, and this is their experience with the civil justice system. My goodness, anything goes in the courtroom, it's just like on TV. Your Honors, I submit that this court has an opportunity to raise us all up to a higher standard. And I think the Schoens deserve that. I think they clearly deserve their fair trial in court.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.